This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. My name is Alan Scott. Bloomberg Government is your only place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11, Fridays at 2:30 right here on Federal News Radio. Today on Capital Impact, we're bringing the world of finance into focus. A little bit later on in the program, we've got senior economic analyst Ian Hathaway. He'll be joining us to discuss a new study he's co-authored regarding the ever-ebbing and flowing housing market. We'll talk to declining equity, underwater mortgages, impact they have on the economy, along with what the government has done to assist. Have we hit the bottom of the housing roller coaster? We'll find out in a little while. But we begin the program with a recap of the J.P. Morgan Chase issue. Yes, President and CEO Jamie Dimon was grilled on the Hill, and to analyze his responses are two people chomping at the bit to say what they have on their minds. They are Dr. Christopher Payne and Dr. Neela Richardson, both of whom are senior economic analysts with BGov. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having us, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Now, the last time we spoke, on this topic anyway, Jamie Dimon, president, CEO of J.P. Morgan, had just completed the shareholders meeting in Florida, during which not a single question came to him about what happened. Where did those $2 billion go? Kind of surprising. About a dozen people, no one said anything. Not exactly the same story on the Hill. Aside from stop foreclosures now, how to say that repeatedly over and over again, Chris, what did you glean from his testimony?
Well, we saw Democrats and Republicans questioning Jamie Dimon, and we saw a lot of that questioning falling down on political lines. I would say that the Democrats tried harder to get to the bottom of the question of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they raised the issue in a number of ways throughout the whole hearing. But I'm not sure they really got the answer. If for someone out there who isn't an expert on finance and synthetic credit positions, which I suspect there's a lot of people out there in that position, they might not be any wiser about what happened. One of the things that Jamie Dimon did say was that they are going to release more information at another meeting of shareholders actually in July, and that one of the reasons they don't want to give out more information now is, of course, that they're still in these positions and it's going to potentially affect any gains, losses that they incur from this point forward. But I think generally we still really don't understand the detail of what happened, and I think that's important. And it's very important for what conclusions we can draw about the Volcker Rule. And obviously the Volcker Rule was very central to the whole discussion. From the Democratic point of view, they want the Volcker Rule. They like it. They want to extend it to cover certain other kinds of hedging activities, supposed portfolio hedging, which led to J.P. Morgan's loss. The Republican position is that really we don't even like the Volcker Rule at all. And if anything, we shouldn't be using this as an opportunity to extend it. We should be unwinding it, and by the end of the testimony, Jamie Dimon was definitely arguing that he didn't like the Volcker Rule either. He made that pretty clear.
He did make that evidently clear. And one thing that I was concerned with right at the very beginning of the hearing was the fact that his initial line of questioning led to the, would you feel more comfortable discussing this behind closed doors? I thought it was going to be shut down at that point. I became a little concerned that we may not actually hear anything until post-shareholders meeting in July. But fortunately, that wasn't the case. Neela, how about you? What did you pick up from this?
Well, first of all, I thought Jamie Dimon's performance was great, to be honest. I thought he dodged the questions that he could not answer because they were still in this position or because he did not know, and he came out swinging on those questions he could answer, saying very directly what he felt about Volcker, Basel, Dodd-Frank, and a number of other regulatory issues. And in fact, pointing out, given the complexity of the regulations that J.P. Morgan faces, it seems a kind of interesting dynamic between questions asking about that, the bank's complexity, when they face such complex regulation. So I thought that that was an interesting comparison.
So one statement that was made, regulators couldn't realistically stop CIO losses. Losses were management mistake, not a regulatory error. So even Volcker, nothing could have stopped this from happening.
Well, not doing it could have stopped it from happening. I think you can't rely, and I think this was Jamie Dimon's point, you can't rely on models to give you accurate information, the total picture of what the risk situation looks like for any trade, and that's where judgment comes into play. And so risk models have to be buffered by good risk management practices, back testing, stress testing, communication with regulators, and no regulator is going to be able to get into the heads of any trader or management executive and figure out whether each individual trade was intended to be a proprietary trade using bank's own money to make bets in the financial market, or indeed was intended as a hedge, and no regulator is going to be able to mandate better risk models.
Chris?
I think, you know, his whole game plan was to focus on how this was a specific issue with JP Morgan and their failure of risk management. Because what he doesn't want Volcker extended. I mean, he made it very clear that he doesn't think the kind of portfolio hedging that they were doing is something that should be stopped. He says it's actually very good. It lowers costs. Hedging is a good thing. And so to make that argument, to say that Volcker shouldn't be extended, you have to say that it was a specific JP Morgan problem. And you have to make the case this isn't something that everyone deals with, that every bank could face this loss. It has to be something that was a specific breakdown from them. And I think he did that. I think he did that quite effectively. I mean, he talked both in his testimony and then through discussions. And from the very beginning, he said, no, this was an egregious mistake. There was a breakdown in risk management. We weren't looking at this at all the different levels of the company as we should have done. And therefore, don't draw conclusions to the wider regulatory environment from this mistake. And that was his game plan today, and he stuck to it.
In fact, there's evidence in the data that this is indeed the case. Bloomberg Government just released a study Wednesday talking about how market trading risk has scaled by book equity has changed over time since the passage of Dodd-Frank and since the financial crisis. This is simple analysis using publicly available data that shows that, in fact, the average trading risk, market risk in the trading book has declined about 20% since the passage of Dodd-Frank in some metrics that again, are publicly available. So there is evidence that Dodd-Frank is having a role in reducing market risk among the biggest banks in the U.S. That could be because of a variety of reasons. There are fewer investment opportunities now than there used to be.
Right.
There's heightened investor and regulator scrutiny. And, you know, Dodd-Frank has caused banks to shed some of their proprietary trading desks, these desks that make these risky bets. And so all of these combined has had an effect. And since it's had an effect, those who want to bulk up Volcker may be overstepping and adding a little bit too much regulation on top of what's already being effective.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. My guests right now are Dr. Neela Richardson and Dr. Christopher Payne, both senior economic analysts with Bloomberg Government. We've talked a little bit about Volcker, and let's talk Basel. Basel I met the criteria, according to Jamie Dimon. What about Basel III?
Well, I think that one of the strongest themes of Wednesday, the hearing, was that J.P. Morgan's a very well-capitalized bank, and we consistently saw questions saying, well, does Basel III mean that banks are so well-capitalized we don't need these other regulations? Has Basel III been a success? And I think we can say after the hearing that, yes, we've got much better-capitalized banks, and everyone buys into that. One thing that Jamie Dimon did say that was quite interesting was that he thinks that there should be a peak capital common equity tier 1 ratio of 8% rather than the 9.5% that JP Morgan is facing, and that longer time needs to be taken to see the effect of regulations before, and then they can be changed. you know, before that they get finalised, that they can be adjusted. And actually, this sounds like sense to me. And I think it's something that you could really extend across a lot of regulations, derivatives, other parts of Dodd-Frank. Try and take things slower, try and see what the effects of regulation are, try and get them as right as possible. Yes, Basel III is very good. It's incorporated into Dodd-Frank. Everyone, I think, is bought into the success of Basel III. If you have a well-capitalised bank, then losses won't endanger the bank as a whole. But maybe we should take our time. I'm not sure if the political process in the US lends itself to taking time. That's the problem.
Something that I found interesting during the hearing was, I think it was Senator DeMitt who said that, you know, this $2 billion, yeah, it's a lot of money, but during that same time period, I think the US lost $3 trillion. So we're talking apples and, you know, a gigantic
apples
apple.
And over, something else.
Apples
entirely.
And something else entirely. Yeah. Exactly.
And they lost many more million dollars on their loan book just making mortgages. So their non-performing assets are multiples of that $2 billion loss. No one's saying that banks shouldn't lend. So that adds further perspective on this loss.
The two of you released a memo, which I thought was amazing. The memo available on BGov now. It's questions for Jamie Dimon, addressed to the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. The questions that are contained therein, how do you think he did? Did he get the memo from you guys? Did he actually answer any of the questions? I know of one answer specifically, which was the last question you asked about banks being too big to fail, but we'll get to that in a minute. In the meantime, let's talk about some of the things that are there on the list.
Well, I think it's interesting to know the genesis of this memo. Chris and I have had a lot of meetings on Capitol Hill discussing this J.P. Morgan loss and what it means in terms of regulation. One of the questions many of the staff members wanted to know is, what should we ask Jamie Dimon about this loss? And so we followed up with this memo that gave some questions we would like to hear from Jamie Dimon.
And I'd like to think that a lot of them were asked.
And I would like to think so, too. One that we haven't talked about is clawbacks and whether Jamie Dimon would be seeking clawbacks from the people he said were responsible for this trading loss. He gave every indication that he would.
Yeah, that was one of our questions, and it got asked. I mean, it's something that people want to know. He actually said that there's never been a clawback before.
It
is.
I found that extremely
interesting. They put the policy in place, presumably after the financial crisis, mm-hmm. and they haven't had need to use it. That clawback goes back 2 years.
Back 2 years, exactly.
2 years. So 2 years of bonuses could come back. They haven't finalized what it would be. They need to realize they really need to see this position out to really know how much they have lost, right. How much past gains on this trade, and there have been past gains on this trade, are going to be offset by losses now. But yes, I mean, this I think to do that, to make it public, sends a clear signal that the incentives should have changed. And that investor prop traders or traders need to think more long term about some of the risks they're taking on. So that was a clear answer. We got out that one.
Does Mr. Dimon believe banks are too big to fail?
He thinks that banks should be allowed to fail. And he gave a several reasons why and several reasons how. Now, whether or not they're realistic, I cannot say at this time, but he did very much assert that banks should be allowed to fail.
I mean, he was he thought that the living wills, this orderly liquidation plan, was very good and could work. I remain skeptical that markets wouldn't so panic, money markets I'm talking about, these kind of interbanking markets, there wouldn't be such a high level of panic and a liquidity crunch. I remain skeptical that an institution as important as J.P. Morgan could be allowed to fail, but that's my opinion.
His name is Dr. Christopher Payne. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. Thank you both for joining me today. Neela, I'd like you to stick around with me because I want to introduce someone else to the program now. His name is Ian Hathaway. I know you know him well. Another senior economic analyst with BGov, who, with you, Dr. Neela Richardson, has authored a study, U.S. Housing Outlook, Skidding Along the Bottom as Policies Sputter. Thank you very much for joining us, Ian.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. So, depending on where you live, the housing outlook may not appear as bleak as in other parts of the country. We've all seen it on TV, housing prices. What can you get for $500? What can you get for $400? In some places, it's really good. In other places, really, really, really bad. Lots of inventory out there. But to call the housing problems resolved might be misspeaking or speaking too soon, according to your study?
Yeah, so there certainly have been some signs of stabilization in the housing market recently. But, you know, one of the things we concluded was that that sort of misses a larger point, that housing is going to skid along the bottom for some time to come, and it's going to have a long way to go to fully recover.
So as we take a look at what is now an election year, are we thinking that this might turn things around, Neela? Will it be better? Will it be worse?
Election years typically do not lead to an increase in policy action right before. So I would say that housing policy is stalled for the moment. And why is that problematic? Well, it's problematic because we need the markets to clear for housing to recover. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about housing. It's about the economy. Housing is typically, as we've calculated in our study, 20% in most years of the economy. And so until housing recovers, the economy can't rebound. And we do need more policy action, even though it's an election year, to really get that recovery ignited.
One of the big things that people are suffering with at this point, according to your study, 31% of mortgage holders are upside down. We're talking about people whose home value is worth less than what they could actually sell it for. Big problem. And it's a problem that continues as foreclosures start to mount. Correct, Ian?
Yeah. So about 55% of housing wealth was destroyed in the downturn. That's been a big drag on the economy because about households spend about $3 to $5 of $3 to $5 less of housing wealth decline of every $100 of housing wealth decline. So that amounts to about $220 billion to $350 billion less in consumer spending each year.
We're talking about $7.4 trillion if my math is correct. I'm pulling it right out of the study, by the way.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about new construction, because there's lots of options that people have with regard to housing. You've got new construction, you've got existing homes. Are there any differences in that at this time?
Well, there are a couple of different markets right now. The first is the difference between new homes and existing homes in terms of prices. So we've seen a bifurcation in the market there. New home prices have started to increase while existing home prices have continued to fall. That is evidence that, you know, new home prices can only fall so far.
Mm-hmm.
Construction companies aren't going to build new homes if there aren't a buyer. Existing homes, as the stock continues to increase with foreclosures, prices are just going to continue to fall. Now, in the construction market, what we've seen is that there's been a rebound in multifamily housing, which is apartments, units of five or more housing units in
mm-hmm.
a building.
Now, are these for purchase or for rent?
These are new construction.
New construction would be for rent.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Very good. Neela?
Ian's absolutely right. I'm not just saying that because he's my co-author. He's quoting from the study. He's absolutely right that there is basically two markets right now. There's the market that you refer to that's going up or stabilizing, but there is another market that is being based on distressed sales of foreclosures or short sales, which is selling the house for lower than the mortgage owed, that's really driving the market in a lot of areas. That market was amplified by the mortgage settlement, which was really a settlement among the largest servicers. Bloomberg Government has a study out on the mortgage settlement on the website currently, and what that settlement did is basically decrease the stop gap in the foreclosure process. And now we can expect that banks are going to put more foreclosures online, and that's going to depress prices even more going forward. And so that's why that's one of many reasons why Ian and I believe that the housing market may not have a rebound yet and may hover around this bottom point for a while.
Let's talk about the government intervention. What is the government doing right now, or what kind of plans are there that can be put in place or are currently in place to help mitigate this?
The government has two flagship home recovery programs. The first is a modification program called HAMP. The second is a refinance program called HARP. The programs have different intents. HAMP is intended to modify existing mortgages to terms so that homeowners can make monthly payments. HARP is to encourage refinancing of underwater borrowers by eliminating cost to refinance. And if you're currently underwater, as a lot of Americans are, you can't refinance a mortgage. You have to have equity in your home.
Right.
So HARP is an attempt to streamline those refinancing so underwater homeowners can refinance. The problem is these programs have underperformed the targets set for them. Through the HARP program, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which actually execute that program, only 1.1 million mortgages have been refinanced. That's far short of what the White House expected from this program.
So what are they doing to kind of encourage participation? Is there anything out there that can be done to make them more interested in HARP?
Well, there are a couple things that have been thrown around, and it's really not borrower interest that, that's the concern. It's banks' interest in refinancing these mortgages, and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae in executing this program. It's also the White House in encouraging these entities to do this program, and the Treasury and Congress in making sure that servicers actually are part of this. So let's just say there's shared responsibility in executing this program. And in an election year, it's easy to just have a stalemate between all these stakeholders. And meanwhile, homeowners are left without tools in order to take advantage of historically low interest rates.
One of the issues that come about as a result of loan modifications, let's say, you've got someone who may not necessarily be underwater, but they are having trouble because they may have lost a job, their income's been cut, they're having issues making the payments. They are allowed to refinance, but they still can't keep up. As a result of the settlement that happened, foreclosures are going to be on the rise.
Yeah, that's right. It's estimated that there will be an increase in foreclosures over the next year and a half to 2 years of about 3.6 million homes. That's problematic for, you know, beyond the human cost to people who have lost their homes. It's also problematic to the market.
Right.
That would put downward pressure on home prices and increases the housing stock. One of the interesting statistics that you can pull out of this study is you know, it's a statistic that really gets shows you the scope of the housing inventory problem. So right now there are about 2.5 million homes for sale in the traditional housing stock. At the current pace of sales, that's about 6 to 6.5 months worth. However, when you include the shadow housing inventory,
right,
which falls outside of the official inventory statistics, it's basically homes that are seriously delinquent or in the foreclosure process, that housing inventory jumps from 2.5 to about 6.5 million, and the months of housing inventory at the current pace of sales is about 16 months compared with 6.5 months.
Big difference.
Huge difference.
Huge difference. Lots of negotiating going on at this point in the housing industry. His name is Ian Hathaway. He's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. Neela Richardson, Dr. Neela Richardson, she is also a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. Their study is called U.S. Housing Outlook, Skidding Along the Bottom as Policy Efforts Sputter. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
That just about does it for Capital Impact here on Federal News Radio. Just a reminder, you can learn more about BGov's award-winning analysis tools and data at www.bgov.com. Use social media types. It's Twitter at Bloomberg Gov. Thanks to Dr. Neela Richardson and Ian Hathaway. Again, their study, U.S. Housing Outlook, Skidding Along the Bottom as Policy Efforts Sputter, is available on BGov. Also, Dr. Christopher Payne, whose analysis of the finance industry can also be found on BGov.com. We'll get together again next Thursday, 11 a.m. Got lots more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.